Hi, this is Alan Shartok. A very special guest is joining us in studio today. Jonathan Soros is Chief Executive Officer of JS Capital Management, LLC, a private investment firm. He's also a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, a think tank based in New York City, and co-founder of Friends of Democracy, a super PAC, an advocacy organization dedicated to reducing the influence of money in politics. Mr. Soros is a member of the board of the New America Foundation, holds several board positions affiliated with the Open Society Foundations. He's also a member of the Next Generation Leadership Board of the Indian School of Business. Prior to founding JS Capital, Mr. Soros spent 9 years with Soros Fund Management, serving as its president and deputy chairman from 2005 to 2011. Mr. Soros has clerked for Judge Stephen F. Williams of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, worked as an assistant director of the International Foundation for Electoral Systems Mission to Moldova, and co-founded the Fair Trial Initiative, a nonprofit that seeks to improve the quality of defense available to defendants facing the death penalty. Mr. Soros is a graduate magna cum laude of Harvard Law School and the John F. Kennedy School of Government. He received his BA from Wesleyan University. Welcome, Jonathan Soros.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How'd you get interested in all this stuff?
The money in politics work?
Yeah.
Well, so you mentioned the time I spent in Moldova. I was there for about 2 months in 1993, working with that foundation to cover their first ever parliamentary elections. And I got a real taste of the way that rules matter in democracy. And then I continued that interest at the Harvard Law School. I studied with Lonnie Guinier, took her course on law and democracy, which is a real eye-opener. And of the issues that were covered in that course, and there were many, the money and politics issue really stood out as one that was interfering with the flow of our democracy.
Well, somebody must be saying to you, Jonathan, if I may call you that, that, you know, you've got some money, obviously, and that you are, you know, successful, and that money talks and all others walk. Why shouldn't you be on that team as opposed to the other team?
Interesting question. I mean, I have a deep and abiding faith in our democracy and in the importance that it be a real democracy that is fundamentally accountable to all citizens. I think to have a system in which a small group of people have inordinate influence over the process and the politics, it's just dangerous. It's wrong and it's dangerous. Right now, it's, I believe, 0.05% of Americans who give a reportable amount to electoral campaigns. When you looked at super PACs over the course of this last election at the federal level, it was a small handful of people who gave the majority of money to super PACs. That's a terrible way to run a democracy.
So you decided to fight fire with fire and develop your own super PAC.
Yeah, so you know, my view was it was driven by several convictions. The first is that there continues to be, even after the Supreme Court's case in Citizens United in 2013, that there is a suite of reforms that are practical and achievable and fully consistent with the Supreme Court's jurisprudence that would fundamentally transform the way that money flows in and around politics. But the second premise was that none of those things get done until you can demonstrate some real political will around the question. Because you're dealing with the rules by which people get elected, they're not going to change those rules unless they feel like voters care. So in 2012, when you had, you know, the birth of the super PACs and the, you know, the first people paying attention to this issue at a level that they haven't since Watergate, it was a real opportunity to prove that point and to break that conventional wisdom. And in fact, a dangerously missed opportunity if we didn't engage. That if what you had was, we ended up with a $7 billion federal election, if you ended up with that, and there was no counter-narrative, there was no other story, then that becomes the new normal. That becomes the, you know, this is just the way it is, and I'm going to throw up my hands. Why should I bother to be part of that? So that's why we engage in this process.
Well, you're a brilliant young lawyer, and certainly one and one makes two, and you have to know that the Supreme Court of the United States has been where you ain't.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, they've made it easy for the continuation of private money to flow into elections unmitigated.
Yeah, so it's never been my objective, my personal objective, to get money out of politics. I don't think, certainly the Supreme Court has made it impossible, at least under the current jurisprudence. But even if it were, I don't believe you can do it as a practical matter. So my objective personally has always centered around creating an alternative. That's why the citizen-funded elections or public funding of elections is so important to that suite of reforms that I mentioned. You have to create an alternative so that candidates can run for office without dependence on the large contributions and the large donors. And that's how you reduce the influence of those donors rather than try to eliminate them.
So is the Obama election, in which a lot of people gave a little, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Partly, but Obama also funded both elections with large contributions. Certainly. And if you look at, I can't remember what the number is. I mean, it was some, I think, 100 or so fundraisers that he did during the course of the campaign. Those fundraisers were principally with folks like me who were writing, you know, checks in excess of $10,000 to his campaign. So, and the same was true in 2008, right? It was a great story, and it's a wonderful example of what's possible when you can draw in small donors. And he funded more of his campaign with small donors than anybody else. But the other side was still true, that where he was spending his time was with larger donors.
Your name is Soros, of course. I'm sure it occurs to everybody that you come from a prominent family. What has that meant to you?
What has that meant to me?
I mean, where did you get these values? Here you are fighting the good fight. You're on the right side. As far as I'm concerned, I agreed to do this interview because I like what you're doing. But, you know, it's untypical of your class, of your social and economic class.
Well, I think it's obvious if you look at the work that my father has been engaged in for...
For the few who don't know, your father is...
My father is George Soros.
Okay.
And really, since the late 1970s, he has been engaged in a variety of activities across the globe to promote democracy and open society. He was intimately involved in the fall of communism in the late 1980s and in promoting the nascent democracies of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union in the 1990s. And so if you want to point to a place where my values come from in that regard, that's the most likely place.
How did he do that with you? I mean, did he sit you down and say, "Now, son," or when you were a small kid, how did he inculcate those values with you?
You know, I've asked this question of myself because I've tried to identify where these come from, and I don't have a great answer for you. But I remember occasions in which, you know, we had black South Africans visiting and discussing the apartheid system in South Africa. And in fact, before he was involved in Eastern Europe, the first forays of the foundation, the nascent Open Society Institute, were actually in South Africa, promoting scholarships for black South Africans so that there was meant to be a new class of folks who could be the future leadership. So I remember a few pieces like that. But really, it was by example. And by seeing these things in the 1980s, which, you know, I was a teenager at the time.
Did you grow up in New York?
I grew up in New York City, yeah.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Trinity School in the Upper West Side.
I know it very well. I went to Joan of Arc Junior High School around the corner. And I didn't like the Trinity kids. I always thought that they were too stuck up and wore blazers. Was that a sort of reverse snobbery?
You know, perhaps. We did wear blazers, at least for a time, until they started relaxing the dress code.
Yeah. So I wanted to get back to the main event here, and that is what's going on in New York. We see a spate of corruption. That corruption is clearly almost always traced back to the evil root of money. We have a state legislature which has glommed onto as much power as it can get and is not sharing that power. We'll never have initiative and referendum in New York State, which would be great. We'll never have, you know, the kinds of ethics laws that would make a lot of sense. And you're coming in like Lochinvar from the West on a white horse, and you want to make this change. How realistic is it?
Well, for starters, one of the reasons it's realistic is because I'm not alone. I've arrived at this party late. There's been a terrific coalition of groups who I'm sure you know well, the Citizen Action New York, the Working Families Party, Common Cause, the Brennan Center for Justice, who have been working on this issue for a long time.
All basically broke.
Perhaps, but they have influence and they have
Influence to have gotten anything done.
Well, look, so this is a hard thing to do. And, you know, one of the reasons that it's live now is that the governor has put it on the table. He put it on the table starting, you know, a couple of years ago in his State of the State address. He did it again last year and this year. He's taken that a step further and gave a great speech a couple of weeks ago to a group of business leaders in New York that I think laid out the case for reform incredibly well and incredibly powerfully.
What is that case?
So there are several cases. You know, there's a case that's based on corruption, and there's a case that's based on trust. And the governor, in part, was arguing the case of trust, that the way that money flows in and around politics distances the ordinary citizen from their politics and leads to a situation where they don't believe that their elected officials are working for them. That's true nationally. We've seen it in polls, and that's true here in New York State. And money and the fact that candidates are being financed by a small fraction of the electorate is at the root of that. So that's one of them. And the other now, you know, coming to the fore with these arrests last week is corruption. And, you know, there's, to be clear, you know, it's not that that reforming money in politics would have stopped these particular...
Well, we know that because New York City has the very plan that you want to implement statewide.
Well, let's start with the fact that there is no law that stops corruption, right? The fact that this was corruption was because it was against the law. So, you know, Malcolm Smith, if he ends up being convicted of what he's accused of, faces up to 45 years in prison. So it's not that if you had made it a 50-year penalty, that would have stopped him from doing it. And the fact that he's been...
Why wouldn't it have stopped him? You think he's just arrogant and he won't?
No, I'm just saying the difference between 45 and 50, the penalty is severe enough.
No, I get it. But I'm saying what makes these guys go wrong is the fact that they're arrogant and they think they can get away with it as opposed to thinking that, you know, 45 years in prison might be a long time.
So in the wake of this scandal, I did a little research. I started doing a little research about the Knapp Commission, which I just thought was, you know, I found a couple of things that I thought were really interesting.
Are you old enough to remember the Knapp Commission?
I am. I'm sure.
And I worked in the New York City Police Department at that time. It's very interesting. And I watched a lot of Law and Order, and they always have a guy who's supposed to be like Whitman Knapp, and they don't make him out to be a nice guy. But go ahead.
Well, so Frank Serpico, when he testified in 1971, he said something along the lines of 10% of cops are completely corrupt, 10% are honest, scrupulously honest, and the other 80%, they want to be honest, right? And so the Knapp Commission takes that testimony, does its investigation, and comes up with a series of systems reforms because they recognize that you can't drum out corruption one guy at a time. There's a limit to what law enforcement can do. When you're dealing with systemic corruption, need systems change.
Yeah.
They didn't give up. They said you need to change the entire structure. So you look at last week and you say, you know, U.S. attorney had a great line in his press conference. So that there's a show me the money culture in Albany. And so that's what you need to you need to change the way that the money flows so that people have a different set of incentives.
But Jonathan,
you increase competition, you increase transparency.
But Jonathan Plunkett of Tammany Hall put it best when he said there's honest graft and dishonest graft. And the reason that I think somebody like Malcolm Smith, if he did what he was supposed to have, is accused of having done, was so stupid is he didn't follow the rules for the honest graft as opposed to the dishonest graft. That's why, you know, I think this culture of corruption thing, which is very interesting to me because I think it's there, but there's a culture of honest corruption, and I think that's what you're talking about because people give the money to the campaigns.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Right, that the entire structure of the place is transactional. I mean, from the very first day that you run for office, from the very first day, maybe there's one thing that comes before it, but pretty soon what you're focused on is finding the biggest donor to write you the biggest check for your campaign.
Right. And you never have to speak into a microphone and say, if you pass this bill, I will give you this money. That's not the way it's done here, is it?
No. So
you're the guy, the $50,000, and then he's yours. Later on, when you need something, he'll give you what you want.
Right. And so what you need to do is to change the entire system by which people get funded for their campaigns. So here's two jokes, right? Guy walks into a bar and comes across his representative and says, I'll give you $50,000 if you vote for this, right? Second joke, guy walks into the bar and says, hey, you know what? I'm thinking about spending $50,000 on political campaigns. I'm really interested in knowing what your position is on X, Y, and Z. So here's what's different about those. One of them's illegal, the other one's legal. Here's what's the same. Neither one of them is funny. They're bad jokes because both of them are a corruption of the democratic process. So if a candidate can run for office where that $50,000 doesn't really matter and they're actually funding their campaigns with small contributions from ordinary citizens, it completely transforms the way that works.
We're talking to Jonathan Soros, and unlike other guests who I've had on this program, he actually stops every once in a while and makes you ask another question. Jonathan, you need to fill in for us the blanks. First of all, there are a lot of people out there who do not want public money to be used for elections. They don't want it. They say these crooks, and I've heard it 1,000 times, and I think it's overgeneralized, but these crooks are going to not only steal from us, and they will always steal from us, but now they'll use our money to get elected. How do you answer that one?
Well, I think there are a couple answers to that. The first is, you know, that's part of the conventional wisdom, right? That's the tried and true argument that people have been laying out for a long period of time. This race, this New York State Senate race with George Amador and Cecilia Kacik last...
Yeah, I want to hear about that.
Yeah. So I think that disproves the point about as well as you can.
How so?
So here you have a campaign where Cecilia Kacik, the Democratic candidate, is vociferously for public financing of campaigns, in particular in this small dollar matching version. Her opponent, George Amador, a sitting assemblyman whom they say the district was designed for.
It was. There's no two ways about it.
Is against it, right? So 3 weeks out before the election, she's in most polling down by north of 10 points. In our polling, it was 13 or 14 points. We got involved in that race with the super PAC that you mentioned.
Did some Your super PAC, yes.
Yeah, New York Friends of Democracy. Right. Did some TV advertising to lift up her name recognition and introduce this issue of money and politics more clearly into the frame.
And she sat in that chair you're sitting in right now twice to talk to us about her election.
And did she?
The first time I thought, I turned around to the producer and said, not a prayer. The second time I said, she could win this. And it was so convincing. And of course, nobody could pronounce her name. So that makes it even worse. That made it
even
worse.
Just go by Cece. It's okay.
Yeah, Cece. Exactly.
But what happened was that George Amador turned around and attacked her for her support of citizen-funded elections. Ran ads, did mailers, called it a CC tax, said it was going to cost, you know, X dollars for the politician, put out his own half-hearted reform proposal that was centered around transparency only. And that became, for those 3 weeks, the primary issue that was litigated over that period. She comes back and wins by 18 votes. Right now, it was only 18 votes, but in a district that was designed for the other guy, and she was down by 13 points, she closes that gap on this issue.
And she only wins. They tried to steal it from her. There's no two ways about it. They went, they found themselves a Republican judge. The Republican judge figured out how some of the votes that she had been denied by the Republicans, but in the end, she got the votes because the next thing happened, they appealed to Democratic court. And she wins. I love her, by the way. And I think that one of the things that's so extraordinary about your helping get her elected is that she didn't forget after she got to the Senate who she was. A lot of these guys, they get elected and they get on the money train right away. But she gets here and she does some of the most amazing work I've seen in the state Senate, insisting on the right kinds of things for children and schools and health. And that makes her a real heroine, as far as I'm concerned, because she didn't forget what did it. A lot of these guys, they get here and they turn around and they start to act like idiots. They start to act like, whatever you say, Mr. Speaker, whatever you say, Senate President, I'll do. She's an amazing woman. And that goes to your point, I suspect, of having gotten her elected.
Well, I mean, that's terrific to hear. And, you know, she's a real person from her district, and I think she's going to represent it well. But the point about her race, going back to the question that you asked, was, okay, people say we don't want to use public money because it's, you know, it's politicians and we don't want to support that. I think that her election goes a long way to disprove that argument.
I don't know, Jonathan, that
voters will, when presented as plainly as they possibly can be, with she wants to use your tax dollars to pay for elections and I don't, right? That she has a come from behind victory and wins by even a small margin, wins by 18 votes. So I think what you're seeing is a breakdown in that conventional wisdom that actually voters are willing to pay for better elections to be more represented in the process. The polling certainly shows that. So now what we've done is we've helped to convert that polling into an actual election result. And we're talking about a fraction of 1% of the New York State budget is what it would cost to pay for this. And the question is, what do you get for that fraction? I think it's 0.1% of the state budget. Right. So for that, then you get credibility and a degree of confidence and honesty in the other 99.9%. And that's worth paying for.
Well, first of all, I certainly agree with you. But just for the sake of argument, she won all right, but she won in an Obama year.
in New York.
A lot
State.
Of them. No. There were a lot of Democrats who turned out to vote for Obama who would have stayed home otherwise. And once they were there, they voted for other Democrats, don't you think?
So, you know, it's New York State where the presidential election is, you know, not as much in play. But either way, getting folks to vote down the ticket all the way down to the state Senate race, you know, she won on the merits of her campaign.
OK, but the second thing I think has a little chutzpah here is that you say that, you know, it's a great victory for having campaign fair campaign finance. Whereas I would say to you, Jonathan Soros, what about all that money you gave her? That maybe disproves the argument.
No, I disagree, because for two reasons. First of all, she was still outspent, right? When you add up the money that Cecilia Katchik and her allies spent, including us, and you add up the money that George Amador and his allies spent, she was still outspent. So what this actually proves is that what you need to run for election is enough money to have a credible campaign and be heard. And she, you know, probably wasn't able to do that. We helped to increase her name recognition and to create a platform that she could then run off of. But people misunderstand in the electoral context, people misunderstand, I think, the role that money plays. The battlefield of campaigns is littered with people who have vastly outspent their opponents.
Sure.
And still lost, right? Meg Whitman is not the governor of California because she spent over $100 million on her campaign because she's not the governor of California. The real lesson is that people who don't have enough money to really run a credible campaign, they almost invariably lose. So we didn't outspend anybody. We didn't blow this out of the water. We just helped create a competitive environment where the issues could be litigated and she had a fair shot at winning. And if she had had the opportunity to get that support directly from her constituents with this small donor matching program, she would have run the same campaign and she would have won.
You can't have it both ways, but I want to argue with you a little bit more for a minute. You know, I talk to a lot of politicians up here, and inevitably they give you a lot of credit, Jonathan Soros. They say, without Jonathan having come into this thing, she would have lost.
First of all, there are lots of other folks who were involved in that race without whom. I mean, she won by 18 votes.
I'm just telling you what I hear over and over and over again.
And I'm delighted to have participated in that. And I think that that's true, that if we hadn't been involved in her race, she wouldn't have won. That's true of a lot of other folks who did on the ground work and other work on her behalf. So I'm not saying that we weren't instrumental in helping her win. I'm just saying don't overread the fact that it was money or spending a lot of money that got her there. In the absence of our spending, she didn't have enough to run a competitive election and get her name recognition out, and for the voters of her district to get to know the person that you've gotten to know.
Oh, I think she's sensational. Okay, so let's talk for a moment, if we can, about the way it works in New York City, just so that everybody gets to understand what this is all about.
So, first of all, it's a voluntary system. So when you decide you want to run for office, you can decide whether you want to participate in a public matching system or not.
Bloomberg doesn't participate.
Bloomberg has not participated. He's self-financed his campaigns, but his opponents have. And I think in this mayor election, we will see all of the candidates on both sides participating. But what does participating mean? You collect a certain number of contributions to signal your candidacy and to become eligible. And then from that point, every contribution from a New York City resident up to $175 is matched 6-1.
It's a lot of money, 6-1.
It's a lot of money. But the result has been a complete flipping of the source of financing for most city council.
Nobody from the city council has been arrested since that system went into effect?
I'm confident that's not true because somebody from the city council was arrested last week. Let's go back to where we started around the corruption question, right? That there is no system, no set of rules that will stop corruption.
Okay.
Right? It's just not, right?
So okay, but let's go back to New York City.
Yeah.
So it's 6-1. Almost everybody gets into it. Mayor Bloomberg didn't. He spent whatever he wanted to.
And yet he had a competitive election last time. People forget that actually that election, you know, wasn't a blowout. It was reasonably close.
Yeah, I would point out he won.
He did win.
Yeah.
But did he win because, go to the Meg Whitman example. Did he win because he spent over $100 million for his campaign? Or did he win because the majority of New Yorkers thought he was a pretty good mayor? Wanted to see him for a third term. And his opponent had the opportunity to run a robust campaign and get a large percentage of the vote.
You make a good point. I would have voted for him. Okay, so what are the deficiencies of the New York City law that we have seen, if any? In other words, is there anything that you would change if you, Jonathan Soros, had a chance to change in the system?
Interesting question. I think there are a couple of things that we're going to have to think about as we move towards legislation at the state level. One of them is that Citizens United has intervened since then. And so the idea that there will be potentially independent expenditures from the outside has to be thought through.
So okay, there are a few people who are listening right now, Jonathan Soros, who still don't know what Citizens United is. So why don't you just briefly encapsulate that for us?
Well, so Citizens United actually sort of stands for now this idea that anybody can spend as much as they want, including corporations, on independent expenditures in elections, going so far as to be able to say, vote for or vote against a candidate. It was actually a decision that came after that from the D.C. Circuit that created super PACs formally. So it's not, you know, Citizens United stands for that whole thing. But that's what we're talking about, is the ability for individuals to spend unlimited sums, individuals and corporations to spend potentially unlimited sums on campaigns. It's worth noting that people could spend virtually anything they wanted on campaigns before Citizens United.
Yeah,
right.
There were ways,
and you just couldn't. There were certain things, you know, you couldn't do. You couldn't go out and say vote for and vote against. But you know, if you look at the election of Scott Brown in Massachusetts in the special Senate election, which was actually only a few days before Citizens United, in the last week of that election, the Chamber of Commerce spent over $1 million and is credited with helping sort of lift him over the top. So it's important to note that this is not a new problem, but what has happened in the wake of Citizens United, I think, is twofold. One is it has catalyzed attention to this issue in a way that it wasn't there before. And I think it was particularly this notion that corporations should be allowed to do it that was offensive to a vast majority of the population.
So in a way, it was a good thing.
There's a benefit to the harm, right?
Yeah.
It has increased that attention. The secondary harm, though, I mean, actually, so my point about this sort of existing beforehand is that actually Citizens United, it's often overstated the difference that it made in the law. It actually wasn't that huge a change in the law, but what's happened is a normative change. It's changed attitudes about this. And so now spending huge sums of money, whether independently or in the form of a super PAC, as I said before, has become an acceptable form of political behavior. And that's a major difference. So you see people engaging in this process, Mike Bloomberg among them, now spending $12 million to support gun legislation. Right? That's become now an acceptable form of political activity. So that's Citizens United in a nutshell.
Okay, carrying on where we left off when I asked you about Citizens United.
So when you come back to what might you change, so all versions of public financing in the past have tended to come with spending limits. So you accept this matching fund from New York City, and in exchange for that, you agree not to spend over a certain amount. We need to reconsider that and think about whether there should actually be a spending limit, or perhaps you should be allowed to continue raising small contributions beyond the matchable amount and continue spending it. So if you imagine, so 2008, Barack Obama was the first president since the system was put in place at the federal level to opt out of the presidential public financing system. Principally because it wasn't big enough. It had become sort of irrelevant to running a nationwide campaign for president. And he knew that he could raise substantially more than that, and that would give him a leg up. If you imagine the presidential system in which instead of getting $100-odd million that with the matching amount, it was $300 million or $400 million, more robust and significant amount. And on top of that, he would have been allowed to continue raising $100 contributions from anybody he could find across the country and spend those on his campaign. He might just have stayed in that system in 2008. So that's a switch that you might think about, is allow candidates to continue raising money from small contributors and not have a spending cap associated.
So let me ask you this, Jonathan Soros. My impression is, it may not be exactly right, but that Democrats are for raising money the way you've described. And Republicans, who have, for the most part, more to protect, are more likely to oppose this campaign finance system. Isn't that right?
That is right. But, you know, one of my firm beliefs in engaging in this process is that's really only because of politics, right? That there's no, when you look at the suite of reforms that's centered around this citizen funding, multiple match of a small contribution system, add to it transparency, add to it robust enforcement and an effective rulemaking agency, and add to it, by the way, real rules around what independent means. So go back to the Supreme Court. Their assertion is that it's okay for an individual or a corporation to spend this money because it's independent from campaigns and therefore won't be corrupting. And yet neither at the state level nor at the federal level do we have effective rules around what that independence means. And so that's an important piece to come back to on limiting the effect of that independent expenditure. But if you look at that array of reforms, there's no ideology in that. There's no reason that Republicans should be against it and Democrats for it. It's all politics. And well, so that's why we've been so focused on changing the politics. I would say beyond that, I think we are getting some hints that within the rank and file of the Republican caucus, particularly in the state Senate, which has been the obstacle to reform in the past.
That's where we're going next. But go ahead.
That there are members who recognize that actually the citizen funding system will be in their benefit over the long term. That if the Republican Party is potentially looking at a sort of structural minority position in the state, and therefore the large dollars that are flowing through the party and supporting their campaigns will start to dry up, that actually as individual candidates, they're much better off if they have a way to finance their campaigns directly from their constituents.
Okay, so real politics, we should explain to everybody, although I've tried, heaven knows I've tried, that Andrew Cuomo really does hold the key here. There is a breakaway group of Democrats who have combined with the Republicans to keep the Republicans, Dean Skelos and others, in office. And we could go into why they did that, but let's just say they did it for whatever reasons. The day that Andrew Cuomo says, okay, breakaway Democrats, back with the other Democrats, the Republicans are now not in the majority, they're in the minority. Therefore, they want to preserve the chances that they don't have to go to the Republicans to minority hell, because in the state Senate, it is minority hell when you're in the minority. You get almost nothing to say. The other guys call all the shots, and Dean Skelos and his people. So when you tell me, Jonathan Soros, that you think what's happening here is that this group of Republicans have suddenly become more progressive, I'm not sure they have suddenly become more progressive and recognize that it's in their own interest. I think they know that Andrew has all the cards. I think Andrew Cuomo is a guy who, if he runs for president either the next time or the time after that, would like to have the bragging rights that he brought this progressive system of campaign financing to New York. That's what I think.
Yeah, but so we're saying slightly two different things. I didn't argue that the Republicans are becoming more progressive. What I argued is actually this shouldn't be perceived as a progressive reform or anything else.
Well, it is. It damn well is.
Well, if you say so. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that it's actually potentially in their self-interest.
Okay, but right?
And that what's blocking this is not that it's progressive or not progressive, but just the pure politics of it.
Well, I'm not always sure, Jonathan, that I agree with you when you use words like it's just the pure politics of it, because I think the politics involve the allocation of resources, and the allocation of resources, as far as those Republicans are concerned, works against them rather than for them. But okay, I don't want to fight with you about that, but I do want to go to the next part of this, which is, are you sure that Andrew Cuomo is really for this as opposed to just for the issue, having the issue? Because, you know, in New York politics, guys are always arguing the issue. He's got the Assembly, he's got the Senate, because those guys have to listen to what he says or they're bye-bye Republicans and it's over. And if he wants it, he'll get it. The real question to me is, how much does he really want it?
Well, what I can tell you is what I know, and I can tell you what I'm reasonably confident the governor knows. So what I know is that we are in this position where we are today because of his leadership and because he put this issue on the table.
In other words, it's become a real issue.
It's become a real issue because he helped put it there.
Okay.
That you mentioned that, you know, the coalition's broke and we haven't gotten it done. Well, it's true that if he hadn't put this on the table at the beginning of last year, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I can tell you that, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, he gave a terrific speech talking about the need for comprehensive campaign finance reform that included the public financing of elections, specified the way that it's worked in New York as a positive example. And I know what he's told me privately, which is that he is for getting this done. And then what I know that he knows, as it were, is that campaign finance reform that doesn't include the public financing is not a victory. And that just getting transparency and some other changes doesn't change the system. It doesn't change the way that candidates fund their campaigns. It doesn't change the incentives. And he knows that the coalition feels strongly about that individually and collectively. He knows that the folks nationally who are paying attention to this issue, both from the media and from other activists, are engaged in New York and interested in this because of the public financing aspect to it. And so, you know, he understands those things.
Well, wait a second. Let me argue with this with you. We know that the only reason the state Senate is still Republican, in name at least, is because Andrew Cuomo wanted it that way. How do we know it? We know he didn't veto the famous bill allowing them to draw their own districts. We know it because he sat by and let these rogue Democrats get together with the Republicans. So you're arguing that he's for it, even though the chances are that if this happens, the Republicans are out of business. That seems a little inconsistent to me. Let the people on the other side of the radio know you're making a puzzled face. Go ahead.
Because you're assuming that if this reform goes through, that that's the end of the Republicans.
Damn right I'm assuming it.
Okay, so I'm not sure I agree with that. That's why I'm making
Well, at least
face.
I've gotten it. I'm not sure, as opposed to, you know, you're wrong.
So, but what you're saying effectively is that, you know, the governor can do whatever he wants and can get anything through.
Yes, I am. And right. He argues this with me all the time. So, no, that's not true, Alan. Yes, it's true.
Right. So what we have seen is that clearly the governor knows how to get things done in this environment.
That he's wants.
That he wants and that he has some leverage to,
well,
to
not
get
sure
done.
He wants those
so
Republicans.
So let's agree to disagree on whether he can get anything that he wants.
Okay.
Right? And say and let's acknowledge that this is hard. This is a hard issue. It's not the only hard issue on the table, but this is a hard issue because what you're talking about is changing the rules by which people get elected.
That's right.
For all of them, Democrats and Republicans.
Yes, that's right.
This is a
system. Because there are Democrats in the state assembly who got there the old way, and they're not going to want to change it.
They all got there the old way, right? This is the way that
there are some who will want the change. But right now, assuming that it passes, there will be Democratic assemblymen, you're quite right, Jonathan Soros, who will say, wait a second now, do I want a whole bunch of fuzzy-haired guys who want to run for office, who will get campaign financing to run against me?
Right. That's exactly right. So it's change. Whether or not the change is going to be, is you can predict that it's good for them or bad for them, it's change. And people who have run and won in a system that has, it worked for them. They won.
Sure.
Right? So change is always hard. I mean, there's been a great analysis done by the Campaign Finance Institute that looked at if you applied without changes, if you just applied the New York City model and the way that the limits work to the way that people have raised money in the Assembly and the Senate, that 95% of them end up with the same amount of money as they would have under the old system. They just get it from a different source, right? They get it from the small contributions, which become more valuable.
Maybe.
And no, I'm just saying but that's exactly, it's that maybe that makes this hard.
But just
right? Because you're changing the rules and that's hard for folks.
But just for the sake of clarity here, what about primaries? Can anybody go into a primary with this money also?
Yeah. So again, depends how the rules are ultimately written, but that goes to the point, right? Which is this is a change that increases competition in our politics, right? It lowers the barriers of entry because instead of having to rely on, finding some big donors, you can, you know, if you have roots in your community, you can cobble together the beginning funds, get those funds matched, and then, you know, be on your way to running a credible campaign. That's, you know, that increases competition. Competition may not be what a sitting legislator wants. So the point being,
not be what a sitting legislator wants.
Well, again, you said it before. Some of them are more open to it than others.
Right.
The point being that this is hard. That getting this through is a significant change. And what our job as a coalition has been is to create the conditions under which this is going to get done, to connect what we know to be a huge latent disgust with not only Albany, but politics in general, right? That people don't like the way their politics works. Connect that with this reform, create the demand for reform. And I think, you know, we got a huge opportunity with these arrests to elevate the issue and to lower the obstacles. Because I go back to this quote from Frank Serpico when he testified before the Knapp Commission in 1971 about police corruption in New York City. He said, 10% of cops are corrupt, right? 10% of them are honest, and the remaining 80%, well, they want to be honest. They're just stuck in a system that ultimately corrupts them, right? And what we're dealing with in Albany is what, again, what the U.S. attorney said was a show me the money culture. Right, you're dealing with a culturalist. You've had 30 assemblymen and senators over the last decade, by some counts, either arrested, indicted, or drummed out in scandal.
Yeah, but that's all a bunch of, yes, it's a lot, but they're all a bunch of dummy idiots. I mean, the guys who get caught. Because they don't have to get caught, they can play the game the other way, which I described in the beginning.
And the point being that I think it's a mistake to say that everybody in Albany is corrupt.
Sure.
I don't think that's right. You have people who go to serve their public and serve citizens, and they want to do it honestly. That they're in this show me the money culture where transactions.
But they can show me the money, which I'm trying to say, by doing it honestly. In other words, the honest system, as you said in your thing about the bar before. Right, but, that's right.
But they're in a system now where there is no trust and no confidence in the honesty.
Okay, I want
to
stop you.
And so, just to make that last point, right? This is hard, but the honest politicians in Albany are going to have to do something hard if they want to be part of a system that engenders trust and respect among their citizens and among New Yorkers. And New Yorkers deserve honest politicians. So this is now the thing that just should be getting done.
We can't disagree. We can't disagree on that. But let me go back. New York City. What was the path, Jonathan Soros, to getting campaign finance passed in New York City? What was the path?
You, I'm sure, know that 1,000 times better
than
that.
Well, that's why I'm asking the question. The question is, they have a system of referendum in New York City in which you can get something like that. We don't have it in the state. If Shelley Silver and Klein, the maverick breakaway Democrat, and Dean Skelos don't want it, they tell the troops in the conference, we ain't going to have it. And they're not going to have it because there'll never be initiative and referendum, as I mentioned before, in New York State. It's going to be the legislature that has to vote for it. Now, we read in the papers that Andrew Cuomo is sick and tired of some of the corruption, that he's going to form a commission to look into the way in which he's allowed to do under the state constitution, to look into the way in which these guys function. I have my doubts whether we're going to see such a system, because then there will be hell to pay in the relationship between the governor and what's left of the legislature. So I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, your point, again, is just reinforcing this notion that this is hard. And if you look at where public financing exists across the country, there's only one place, the state of Connecticut, that has done it by legislative vote. And everywhere else, it was done by referendum. And in Connecticut, it was done following scandal. Mm-hmm. And so scandal is is a great friend to reform.
Yeah, it is.
So,
and in Connecticut, they just passed a gun law based on that awful tragedy that they had, making your point once again.
Right. But I think what we're seeing here, right, is you're seeing effectively systemic corruption. Right. And when you have, so you want to have a...
Really? You think that's systemic? Some jerk goes out and...
30 people over a decade.
Over how many years?
Over a decade.
Yeah, well...
30.
You and I could spend a whole other program talking about...
Comparing Chicago and New York State?
Comparing who they are and what motivates them and what they come out of and, what their group is and all the rest of it.
So whether you want to call it a culture of corruption or I think that the show me the money culture is even a better way to think about it. When you're dealing with a systemic problem, you need systems reform. That there's a limit to what you can do with law and order. If you want to have a commission and see if you can dig out more examples of corrupt activity, great. But what you know is that at the outcome, you're going to need to have systems changes. You need to, and that's what the Knapp Commission did, right? It said, we've got systemic corruption in the New York City Police Department. We need to change the way that this whole thing works.
Well, thank God it's Jonathan. Thank God all that systemic corruption in the New York City Police Department is all gone now. That's sarcastic.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah.
But you don't think it's better than it was 40 years ago?
I don't know. I was working in the department at the time all of this was coming down. And I had a very good friend who was at the top echelon who said, boy, you turn over a rock, and there it is. There's so much power invested in cops and so much power invested in our politicians.
Let me just finish that last point.
Sure.
That you're going to need systems changes. And go back to before, right? No single change is going to eliminate corruption because you can't eliminate corruption, right? There's always going to be people who do stupid things, who are venal, or idiots who break the law,
sure.
Right? But what you can do is change the way that the systems work. This one's here. It's in front of us. We've been talking about it for years. The governor has already put it on the table. I think it's quite clear, in fact, quite obvious, the way that changing the way that campaigns are financed fundamentally changes the show me the money culture.
Okay, so do and I. I agree with you, and I hope you succeed. Now, the question I have for you is this. How do you hold individual legislators, who we both agree, may not think that this is the best way to preserve their power? How do you get them to do what they may consider to be against their own self-interest?
Well, so the Assembly, we know, has done this for years and years. Right? They've been passing a one-house bill for a long time.
One house, they'd let the Republicans do the dirty work and kill it. But what happens when it really becomes a chance of passing?
Well, you do what we're doing, right? You create a campaign. We had an electoral piece of it in November, where I think we collectively, a group of folks and a great candidate, collectively demonstrated that this issue has force at the ballot box, that you can genuinely lose your election if you're on the wrong side of it. I think that's a message. You mentioned it earlier, right? Everybody in Albany seems to think that that was part of what happened there. So that's pretty important. And, you know, and you build public pressure. You connect the...
How do you do it? Can you put their pictures up on the internet and say, these are the people individually, and can you do emailings to the various constituencies and say, your guy is against public campaign financing? I mean, is that the kind of thing you can
absolutely do that. And, you know, what I'm hoping for is that you can, at this stage in the game, we can appeal to the better nature, not the worst nature of folks, and talk about the real positive aspect of being part of this change and celebrate the folks who are for it, make it encouraging and a positive experience to be for it. And I think that's hopefully going to lead us more likely to success than the opposite. I certainly hope we don't end up in a place where this is about bashing people and calling them out on being against reform. But if it comes to that, then that's going to be part of it too.
So, you know, have you talked with the leaders? I mean, have you talked to Dean Skelos? Have you talked to Jeff Klein? Have you talked to Shelley Silver about this?
I've had conversations with some of them, as have other members of the coalition and other folks who've been advocating for this for a long time. And I think in the next several weeks, you're going to see some very positive movement in the legislature on this issue.
What makes you think so?
Indications are that this is going to move forward. I mean, last week in New York at a rally that both Shelley Silver and Andrea Stewart-Cousins attended,
She's the head of the regular Democrats in the state Senate.
Both of them spoke quite plainly about the need to get this reform done. And as I said, I mean, Leader Silver has been
leading these bills.
Passing these bills. He's been carrying this bill, I think, for over 20 years. So I think over time, I think political competition is at the core of this.
Me too.
And political competition is good for all of us.
We agree on that. We're out of time. My guest has been Jonathan Soros, Chief Executive Officer of Capital Management, LLC, a private investment firm, a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and much, much more. Jonathan, again, thanks so much for being with us. I'm Alan Chartok.